Artists, actors, culinary crews, musicians, and writers of all different hues. We'll find ways to support you when times are tough. Because a radio show's nice, but not quite enough. Welcome to Spectrum West, everybody, where the arts and culture of Western Wisconsin have a voice, and where at this exceptional time in our nation's history, we can talk about how to ride it out with style and substance. I'm Al Ross, and this week, three conversations related to our COVID condition and one about a different history, a nice diversion, Jim Oliver, and author Bob Silbernagel on his book, The Cadots, Fur Trading Family on Lake Superior. Before that, Nick Meyer, publisher of Volume 1 on how they're affected and working to ease the effects on others they serve. Kevin Tharp teaches digital communication technology at UW Stout. When their day-to-day apple cart got overturned a couple weeks ago, Kevin took what appeared daunting and made it much less so. There, got that out. And here's where we begin. Many of the artisans in our midst live in a world where nothing is guaranteed, supplied, or served. They either make it or find it. Thankfully, there are strong organizations who represent their interests and help create provisional opportunities. Arts Wisconsin and the Wisconsin Arts Board are two. Ann Katz and George Sugros lead them, respectively. We talked with them periodically and felt this was a good time, too.
You know, we always have been a resource-sharing organization for over 25 years. Mm-hmm. Now we've ramped into overdrive in terms of getting information out there about what is happening day by day, minute by minute, and what could possibly happen in the long term, whatever that means. So we've been gathering, trying to figure out and disseminating information on everything from SBA loans, disaster unemployment assistance, what the federal aid package is going to be, what the state aid package could be, what kind of resources are there from private groups, and how all of this affects and could help creative businesses, for-profit and nonprofit, and the independent gig workers who are out there who saw their performances, events, exhibits disappear overnight. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a huge part of this sector. And so we're doing listening sessions. Both the Arts Board and Arts Wisconsin and a lot of other groups are just dumping information on our websites and sharing information as much as possible. We started a listserv. Yeah. Running madly.
I went to both of your websites, obviously, over the weekend, and I have to say that your sites remind me of those brochure racks in a hotel lobby. There's a lot of stuff going on.
Well, and that's a really good point, because making it clear so that people can actually get to the information,
sure,
that's a huge part of the challenge. We can just keep dumping information, but here's what you do now. Here's mm-hmm. where you go to for this. We're trying to do that as much as possible, too.
One thing that caught my eye on the artswisconsin.org website was a thing called Arts Ready. That seemed to me real timely feeling.
Yes, it's the National Association of Emergency Preparedness in the Arts or something, and I don't know if George was on this, but they had a webinar last week. And, you know, they're out there. They're more prepared than the rest of us. They are all about being prepared. So mm-hmm. we've been taking their information and sharing it as well.
Okay. George, what's going on at the Wisconsin Arts Board?
Well, and as Ann said, as we try to assemble and curate resources for people so they don't get overwhelmed, the other thing we're trying to pull together, Al, is the creative responses, and whether those are people jumping online and singing or teaching classes or whatever the case may be, there's that piece of it related to creativity and expression. You know, it's both those things because, as Ann said, I mean, I think we need healthy businesses, healthy nonprofits, healthy artists, healthy other kinds of creatives. And then we need them at this moment more than ever to do what they do.
Yeah.
And so we're trying to assemble that kind of a list as well, because it's amazing how quickly people have gone to things like Zoom and other digital platforms to get their expression out there and remind people that they're still there, even if the crisis is ongoing.
Yep.
Yeah, it's really impressive. I mean, it's humbling and inspiring, because instantaneously. People, they just can't help themselves. It's like, okay, here's something I could actually do. I'm going to put this online. I'm going to gather this information. I'm going to sing out the window and film it. Milwaukee Rep put a whole production online, and for $15, you can view the streaming version of it. I know a local performer in Madison who's doing an arts education live stream every morning and getting the word out about that. And so we have to be inspired.
It's easy to call yourself creative when times are good, but when times are bad, you either live up to that label or you don't. And
humans can't help themselves but be creative. That's the thing. In good times and bad times, people instinctively seize their creativity to do something.
The myth is that creativity happens when there are no constraints. And the reality is that the best creativity happens with constraints, and Lord knows that we're facing all kinds of constraints right now. And of course, this is always the case, isn't it, that the artists are at the leading edge as we try to cope with things. The artists are writing, the artists are singing, the artists are painting, the artists are doing what they can to put what words sometimes can't tackle into things that people can actually digest and find comfort in or think about.
We're on the phone with Ann Katz, Director of Arts Wisconsin, and George Sugros, Director, Wisconsin Arts Board. George, on your site, I noticed that there were a lot of funds listed. Actors Fund, Arts Administrators of Color Network, Women's Arts has a fund, Dramatists Guild Foundation, and several funds I thought I saw on the website are also in development.
Yeah, for sure, because first off, people try to take care of their own, which is why you see all those different arts disciplines creating funds to take care of their people. But also communities are trying to take care of their own as well. And Ann said early on, we've got a situation where nonprofit arts people who, let's say I'm a dancer in a particular community, I might have had two or three jobs that were allowing me to be that dancer in the community. And now not only do I not have my dance job, but those two or three other gigs are evaporating around me. So how do I make my rent? How do I pay my bills? How do I get the food on the table? These are real issues. These funds that are happening in the private and nonprofit sectors, and then how the government will respond, will all be very important to seeing how the health of our industry in the state of Wisconsin, which is a $10.1 billion industry, as noted by the National Endowment for the Arts and the Bureau of Economic Analysis. This is not a small industry in our state. These people who are at the front lines of the industry are hurting. And as I say, the private, nonprofit, and governmental funds are going to be crucial to them getting back up on their feet.
I'll just jump in to add to what George said to sort of make the point about the messages that are out there. You know, we're gathering information about the grants and the opportunities and the funds as well. There are two parts of this message. One is that creativity is fundamental to the human condition. You can't stop it. You don't want to stop it. It's what we need in good times and even more importantly in bad times, because we have to be creative right now to figure out what to do. And we need the arts and creativity around us to be able to try to make sense of any of this. And so the intangible component of why the arts, quote unquote, are important is crucial. Then, as George said, the other half of it is not about the arts at all. We're talking about businesses that employ people. Mm-hmm. We're talking about self-employed people that, you know, are their own business. We're talking about businesses and people that pay payroll taxes, that pay salaries, that cover unemployment insurance, that add to the economy with the economic impact, as George just noted, $10.1 mm-hmm. billion statewide, $877 billion nationally, and almost 100,000 jobs, which is more than the beer, papermaking, and biotech industries. It's not that we're talking about non-essential industries and the arts are not part of that. The arts are an industry that employs people and that people need to be able to make money to feed their families. And so when we talk about SBA loans or unemployment, disaster unemployment for self-employed people, those are employed in the arts as much as any sector. And so we really are trying hard and doing our best and, you know, pushing madly to make the point that the arts sector is a business sector that needs to be part of the recovery efforts.
My conversation with musician Randy Sabine last week, who, by the way, has written a song, if you didn't know about it. It's called Corona, Corona.
We love him so much.
To the old rock song, Corina, Corina. So we played that. I told him of an analogy that I've always had. Independent artists and self-employed people have always appeared to me to be like the wild animals of society. Domestic animals, they just lie around and their people feed them and they let them out. But these other people, they have to find their meals and they have to go out and make a life for themselves. As this continues, it kind of resembles for these people, these wild animals, the coldest, snowiest winter or the longest summer drought, continuing that analogy. So interesting thing is they'll be the last ones to whine about it. They'll find something to do. So your jobs at the heads of your organizations, they're rewarding in a very human way in normal times. And today, coupled with all the concern that you're addressing, I've been talking to people about silver linings. Let's get to that point. And yeah. I talked with Nick Meyer this morning about silver linings and how we're all going to come out of this and everything after this is going to feel like an annoying speed bump and we'll all be so much better for it and so much more prepared, good Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts. It must make you guys at the heads of these organizations even more proud of who it is you represent, and you will carry that going forward.
Absolutely. And yeah. It's what fuels us to keep doing the work.
This is definitely what we need to be doing. Again, as we've said, it's very inspiring to see what people are really trying to do, trying so hard to figure out what to do. And so we have the opportunity to promote that and to try to help.
And it's especially important when we are making the economic argument that we're really focusing on these guys at the front lines. Because there is no creative economy without the creative. And so as we are fueled to go back and do the fight, this may be the moment where we're able to shine a bright light on this work for people who may not have otherwise understood that this industry was so important to their communities and to the well-being of our state.
And I hope, as a final parting shot, I hope we are in the process somewhere along the line. We have more important things to do at the moment. But let's get to eventually planning a really big celebration for when this is all over.
Yes. We are going to have a statewide musical extravaganza of some sort.
I think Make Music Day, if it happens, should be
If things are, I'm putting little air quotes around this, back to normal by then,
sure.
Great.
And George, your websites, are they the very best source for people to go to?
We would say there are many, but I think we are working our best to bring those to one place so people don't have to go look at multiple sites. So, yes, the best for Wisconsin at this moment. Let's brag a bit, Ann, and say yes.
Okay, good. You can brag anytime you want to on my show. Ann Katz, George Sugros, thanks. You're busy people, although you're probably doing it from home, and that's got to feel weird. I should ask you guys what you're wearing now, but I won't.
I've been trying to take a shower and get dressed every day, but actually, I worked from home anyway, but now I'm on Zoom 45 hours a day, so I do have to, look somewhat presentable.
Thank you guys for being with us. Please keep in touch and tell us about the celebration when it's planned.
Absolutely. Thanks, Al.
The websites are artswisconsin.org and artsboard.wisconsin.gov. Good people, good ideas. Coming up, Jim Oliver helps us forget the virus for a while, but next, an example of coping and teamwork on Spectrum West. Support for WPR comes from Marquardt Toyota, offering the fully redesigned RAV4 with all-wheel drive and new safety features located off Highway 53 between Eau Claire and Chippewa Falls or at MarquardtToyota.com. As you can tell, a lot of folks are stepping up to help in any way they can. Who would have thought online learning and subsequently online teaching would become the standard for literally everyone? Well, it happened, and many teachers were without the nuts and the bolts and unrehearsed in the process. So Kevin Tharp, an associate professor of digital marketing and communication technology, gathered his toolbox, jumped on a white horse, and rode to share what he knows with his UW Stout colleagues. Well, Kevin, you are a liberator of sorts, having created what is being called a crash course in alternative learning teaching. And you did it quickly, which is a word that everybody appreciates today. When it comes to alternative learning teaching, instead of Cliff's Notes, there will now be Kev's Notes.
Made that up.
So before we get into all that, let's get a better idea of your normal role at UW-Stout. Give us an idea of what it is you teach, the courses.
The area that I am in is called digital marketing technology. It's actually a degree that I created in conjunction with everybody else, but I was the lead. And that focuses on how we use the technology in the marketing area. So really it comes down to things like data and communications and how do we use those tools so that we can communicate to the people that we're marketing to.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I also happen to be a teacher, and teaching and marketing are very similar in that way, in that what we're trying to do is create a message so that we can capture the attention of whoever it is we're trying to send that message to and hold their attention long enough that we can deliver our message and hopefully get them to act on whatever is our goal. And that happens in those places where our goal and their goal match up.
Many teachers instruct in things that kind of remain rather like a nice quiet lake compared to what you teach, which is more like a whitewater rapids and you're in a kayak. First of all, this whole coronavirus calamity changes day to day. But even during normal times, you must have to check the trades almost as often for innovations and developments, et cetera. So it's probably an exciting field to mentor. Plus, your days probably fly by.
Yeah, there is never a lack of things to learn. The way that I define, the way that I live my life, the way that I teach, I call it living in the seam. And the best way that I can define that is if you go to the beach, there's the beach, there's the ocean, and then there's that section in between the ocean and the beach where the waves are washing in and washing out. And you can't plant your feet there or the waves are going to wipe you out. You've got to be agile. You have to keep moving. But it's also the best place to find the good shells because they haven't washed up on the beach yet for other people to pick them through.
Oh, sure.
It's where things are really dynamic. And that's sort of where I live my life.
Well, it's also where you plant a footprint 1 minute and 30 seconds later, it's gone.
Yes.
And that's kind of the way things go with technology nowadays. They used to talk about planned obsolescence. Well, heck, that isn't, it's not even planned anymore. It's obsolete yesterday.
Yeah. And so when you're living in a world like that, what we have to look at is how do we help students learn how to exist in an environment like that, realizing that, say, if I'm teaching a search engine optimization course,
mm-hmm.
the techniques that I teach them today, by the end of the semester, may be invalid. So we can't focus on this is how you do this. What we have to focus on instead is we teach process. What is the process of building a website? What is the process of viewing the data from a online presence to see where to make decisions to help them make more money? So that process that allows you to not get bogged down with where you're at right now, but to be able to see and predict where the future is going to go so that when the future gets here, you're already prepared for it.
Yeah. I was going to say it almost would seem like a waste of time to write a textbook for what it is you teach unless it just handles only process.
Right. And I've thought about building a textbook, but that is a major barrier. If you're going to be talking about how to do something
sure.
and you're not talking about process, it's going to be obsolete before you get there. In fact, some of the stuff that I've used in my crash course in, I call it crash course in teaching online.
Okay.
The alternative learning is the terminology that is being used by our administration. That's good. This is a nice time for people to understand that. My challenge with that kind of verbiage is that it somehow implies that teaching in a digital realm is somehow other, alternative. And I get it. The world has been teaching
face-to-face forever.
Mm-hmm.
But teaching in the digital realm can be done as well or better in some places than it can be taught face-to-face. I'm actually a better teacher online than I am face-to-face.
Ah. We're on the phone with Kevin Tharp. He is an associate professor of digital marketing technology at UW Stout. He's being given a lot of credit for helping a lot of folks who are also associate professors and assistant professors and professors transition to online teaching as they've had to do during our current healthcare scare. I perused, Kevin, your curriculum vitae, and it's impressive, and it almost feels, I have to say, like what we're experiencing now, and your ability to help your colleagues was part of your destiny. I mean, this is right up your alley. Does it feel that way to you too?
Yes, absolutely. It's kind of funny because I've actually said that it seems to me like my entire career has been preparing me for this moment. You know, the combination of teaching and technology and community and online community, and ultimately the area where I got my doctoral dissertation is in the use of technology for community benefit. And social isolation is the thing that I'm hearing. I was just listening to On Point a few minutes ago. That's one of the big concerns, and that's my concern right now, too.
Well, walk us through the process as it unfolded at Stout. When you saw your opening and whether or not you needed permission to begin your process, or you simply saw a need and jumped in. How did it go?
Okay. We got a notice last week. I think it was Thursday at 2:12. It may have been Wednesday at 2:12. Either way, the email came out at 2:12 that all of our classes were going to be transitioning to an online mode of distribution instead of face-to-face.
Mm-hmm.
And I went on my Facebook, and I instantly saw professors and teachers, not just professors, but teachers at all levels who were like, I don't know how we're going to do this. I teach this course, and I teach that course, and I've never thought about this. I don't know how we're going to do it. And I was like, you know what? That's a place where I can help. So it was within an hour of that email going out where I realized that this is a way that I could help out my colleagues, where I could help out the broader community of people who are trying to transition into a new mode of teaching, a new mode of learning, a new mode of communicating with students and faculty. And I really just sat down and I started throwing out ideas, and I figured I'll organize these later. But I have been studying an area called Universal Design for Learning. That was the area that I focused my research on. And that became a core element of this, because when you're trying to teach people to learn, no matter how you're trying to deliver that, what that says is don't build barriers into your course content that will prevent somebody from learning, if at all possible. So it makes you think about people who maybe can't see or can't hear or have attention deficit challenges, or they can't learn from videos, or they can't learn from text. There's all different kinds of ways that people have challenges with learning. And so that was what came to my mind, is that background that I had is, okay, how do we put something out there that will help people make this transition in a way that's not going to create barriers?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, realizing they were only going to have some of them 2 or 3 days to make this transition, you also have to understand what you can and can't do. So there's some practical tips that I threw in there too. You know, what works, what doesn't work, what is the attention span? You know, if you put up a 80-minute video, chances are people aren't going to see the last 75 minutes of that.
Yeah, right, yeah. So what vehicles did you use to get this information out? Did you put a YouTube video together or to walk people through things, or was it all on quote-unquote paper? What was it?
Paper's not really a thing in my life.
I hear you. Yeah. I was using the term paper kind of as a virtual thing, a computer screen.
Yeah. So on our campus, we have the Office 365 suite of software.
Mm-hmm.
And in there is a tool called Sway, S-W-A-Y.
Okay.
And what Sway is kind of like a modern day PowerPoint, but not. It's a place where you can very easily add different kinds of content. So I was able to put down my ideas, and then I didn't create any new videos for this. I pulled out videos that I had already had in my teaching. Mm-hmm. Now, I will be creating some new videos, but this tool allowed me to embed videos that I had already posted to YouTube. I had a colleague, Cammie Peterson, who had created a walkthrough on how to find and use Microsoft Teams for one of the classes that we're teaching this semester. And so it's like I was able to just take that and put it in there. And that's what I'm trying to do, is get as much efficiency out of existing resources as possible and build new things in conjunction with whoever out there is also doing the kind of stuff, because there's no way I can do this all by myself. I'm just coordinating it. So yeah. There's a lot to know. There's a lot to learn. And I'm proposing to turn this into a vast resource for onboarding people that are new to teaching online, or even some of us older folks that have been doing it for a while, to a place where you can go and do some just-in-time learning to, this is the way that I can use Teams to do group work, or, you know, whatever the case may be.
Well, I must say, we're all looking for and hearing about silver linings among the cloud bank that we're in at the moment. And one very definite shiny reinforcement is the skill that your colleagues will have going forward. You and they must be feeling pretty good about that.
I absolutely do. I've felt, and a lot of my colleagues that I work closely with, we actually design for online and then adapt that content for teaching face-to-face when we do. And we've felt that that is a strong way of going about this. We've been proselytizing that for a while. It's like, this is a way to teach that is very efficient and can allow you to teach in different ways. But there's going to be a lot of people that are exposed to a new way of thinking about teaching and learning. And I personally think that it was time for that. So we hear a lot of complaints from different sectors about, you know, this is wrong with the educational system, that's wrong with the educational system. This is a point in time where the educational system, along with everything else, I believe, is going to go through a rapid change. And we have the technology in place that is very easy to interact with, that should allow us to do that. Those of us who've been doing this for a while, because I've been teaching online for about 15 years, it's a lot easier now, by the way, but we know those mistakes. And if we can put out that knowledge about best practices or ways, alternative ways to doing things, and that's where the alternative learning comes in. It's like, okay, this is different than what a lot of people are used to. It's not all going to be online, but the techniques that we all learn can still be used to improve teaching, even if it's back to face-to-face teaching after we get through this crisis.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hope you will accept Wisconsin Public Radio's virtual, it has to be virtual, pat on the back. I mean, way to go. I'm guessing that you're probably getting some hearty thanks from the colleagues that we've talked about. You're one of the guys that's helped people get prepared for if, hopefully just an if, not a when, something like this might happen again. You've helped people streamline. So way to go, Kevin Tharp.
Thank you very much.
Spectrum West on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Al Ross. Good to have you along. As you would certainly expect, the team at Volume 1 is deeply involved, as we at WPR are, with those in the arts and cultural neighborhoods of the Chippewa River Valley and western Wisconsin during normal times and whatever we'll end up calling the times we're in. The Eau Claire entity that produces printed, online, and social media is reeling with both the unknown effects it will ultimately have on their business, but also the unfolding effects on those they serve. Nick Myers, publisher and editor, Just hours before Governor Evers' Safer at Home proclamation, I visited the Volume 1 headquarters this week for a conversation across the table. So before we talk about Volume 1 initiatives in response to our predicament, and I know you have a few, I'd like to talk philosophy. I've always told clients that it's important to know your market. If you do, you can make good decisions. Volume 1 prides itself in knowing its market, having a friendship with its market. Wisconsin Public Radio, I think, feels the same. In fact, I know they do. We have conversations with our neighbors every day. Many conversations today include the prediction that after this passes, we will all be better at what we do, smarter, more appreciative of things we take for granted. The way I've said it is we've kind of hit the reset button. Is that kind of how you feel?
I do. I hope that that's true, what you say about us all being better at what we do and being more aware and thankful. I think the reset button has been hit very hard here at Volume 1 as we figure out how to get what we do out to the community. Obviously, we have a website and email lists and social media and everything like that, but the main product, our print issue, is a little bit harder to get to the people. And so we're working on ways to do that. When the events started to cancel and then the restaurants started closing and the retailers start closing, we are obviously a heavily promotion and advertising of what's happening in the community oriented organization, and that floor has totally fallen out from under us, and so we're figuring out how to adjust.
Joni Mitchell, Counting Crows, and others have reminded us, don't it always seem to go, you don't know what you've got till it's gone. Those of us out here who ingest and digest all things Volume 1, forget that you too are a human machine, and although you regularly deal and live in a creative and changing world, you must also be seeing things within your own walls that are out of the ordinary. Instead of things happening, now it's things not happening. It's all about people, isn't it?
It is. We are an organization that is built on the backs of very creative individuals who suddenly can't do their jobs the way that they had, which was covering other people doing what they do.
Those people aren't doing what they do, right?
Right, exactly. So, but I mean, I think, you know, I think the world, as connected as it is now digitally, is more ready for a situation like this. You're seeing musicians that are doing, live online broadcasts of music, mostly with just the goodness in their hearts at this point. They haven't found a lot of models for that to work economically for them if they're not able to be on tour and things like that. They're not paying bills. The venues aren't paying bills. You know, the people who distribute food and beverages to those venues aren't paying bills. And there's just everybody is so connected to this thing, not only from the health standpoint, but economically. And I guess there's a lot of concern about, where that is all going to go next. But, yeah, we as people at Volume 1 and people in the community figuring out how to reconnect in a new and different way, and we're trying to rise to that occasion in the same way everybody is right now.
Do you see that making yourselves better?
Better at what we do as Volume 1.
More fluid, more versatile, more prepared, more ready for anything.
Yeah, well, it's definitely true. There will never be, I can't fathom how there could be, a speed bump bigger than this one. How deep and wide and far this goes is obviously yet to be seen. I think a lot of people are still very focused on the health aspects of this, as they should be. But I have, very deep concerns about the community going forward, who's going to survive, who is not, and what that's going to mean and how we're all connected. But going forward, we do have to get better at what we do, all of us. And I think we're pivoting to how can we make, more and better content faster to react to something like this. You know, I've thought in the past about, what would Volume 1 do as a media organization? Because we're not traditional news. We're not, late breaking whatever's happening in the community or, house fires and car crashes and things like that. But if there was ever a big tornado or something here, what would Volume 1's role be to cover that? None of those circumstances really involve the entire world shutting down like this does. It is, as close as you can get to kind of an apocalyptic sort of scenario without actually being in one. And so we don't have the tools to figure this out right now. Our staff is dealing with a very difficult situation where we have, a lot of businesses aren't in as good a position as maybe we might be with some, some resources to try to make it through for a while. But we are slowing our work down so we can afford to last a while, not knowing how long this will last. Just as a business owner, it's a very scary time when you are responsible for the income and livelihood of, we have 18 full-time people here and another 10 part-time people and trying to make sure that they can make it through this with the resources that they need to survive so we can come out on the other side and keep telling the stories of this community.
There are certain retailers out there, grocery stores, we've all noticed it, who have bare shelves. It can be said that Volume 1's shelves are a little bare right now.
They are. We're unusual because we've got the magazine and the website and all the media pieces that we do. We have the events that we produce. We have the store ourselves. We aren't ordering product anymore as we don't know if we're going to be shutting down for a couple months or what. Of course, the online piece at thelocalstore.org is still doing well, and we're seeing a lot of support there like a lot of local retailers are. And I think your listeners know that a big thing they can do right now if they're in a position to is to go shop online at these local retailers all over the community. We can't afford to have anybody close over this. But right, a big piece of our currency in the community are the events that we create. We don't know if our summer concert series can launch on time or what that's going to look like right now. We've already canceled some of our food truck events. Our Great Big Hullabaloo, which is an amazing children's event that we've been planning, that is all canceled. And so the revenue that comes with those things are canceled. The opportunities for the community to connect with itself are all canceled. They're scary things, and we're just trying to figure out what pieces we can still do. And that's where we've launched at our website at volume1.org a pulling together while staying apart concept on there. So we basically have scrapped all the usual content around the events and the things that are happening in the community in favor of stories and videos and feeds from different community organizations all pulled together in one place.
Sitting in the Volume 1 headquarters, Nick and I are distanced, as we should be. I did paraphrase some of what you had sent on the show last week. I mentioned your name and some of the specific suggestions that you had made. Let's get to some specifics. Tell me about the Save Your Faves thing.
Oh, right. Yeah. Well, we knew we had restaurants were in big trouble. The second everybody had to close, most restaurants only have, you know, a few days a week, maybe 2 weeks of operating capital to work with. So they are in a particularly dire circumstance, and we knew that we had an amazing database through our Eat Scene restaurant guide that we produce in print and online, that we had photos of every restaurant, phone numbers, email addresses, websites, all that kind of stuff. And so we basically just transformed that as quickly as we could and did a big, thorough list of everybody of who was still open for delivery, who had gift cards that you could buy online, who you had to call for gift cards and stuff, and we created that Save Your Faves. It's at volume1.org/Save Your Faves to show people how they could order delivery or curbside pickup or buy gift cards online. And then we also added in retailers there as well. Just because my biggest fear in this is that we lose some of our favorite things in this community. There are restaurants and retailers who will not survive this. And so if people have places that they want to support and want to make sure they see through, if you're in a position to and have the resources now, maybe your job or your life hasn't been as economically affected by this through whatever it is that you do, you're in a position to be able to help. So please consider doing that, and going to that volume1.org/Save Your Faves is one way you can look into doing that.
One of the things I think the Volume 1 people are very good at is sitting around a table and coming up with ideas. You, I guess, I would wager, are probably doing that fairly regularly. You feel kind of that's your responsibility as a medium?
We do. I keep a lot of keep tabs on what is happening in the alternative weekly world. That's sort of the category of media that we fall into. The City Pages in Minneapolis or Isthmus in Madison, those are all alt-weekly papers. So I've been following what's happening on email lists and things through them, and they are all laying people off across the country. And unfortunately, last week, Isthmus actually closed its doors temporarily, and they are just shut down. So that means they're dark. They are not able to serve the community in the way that they usually do. And I am very dedicated to that not happening to us. We want to keep a dialogue going with the community right now. I think it's important that people know what's happening with the health situation and with the county and everything that's going on, you know, nationally and with the state and even locally. But it's also really important that as we get more isolated right now in our homes, that we can still feel like we are a part of the community that we love, the one that we are living in, and we're connected to that heartbeat, because the heartbeat has not stopped. It has just changed. So for Volume 1 to be here and to be able to keep connecting people to that spirit and keeping people kind of lifted up through it, while still knowing that there's important, you know, real hard news to know, there's still creativity happening. There's still entrepreneurship happening. There is still a sense of community to be built, fostered, and saved right now. And so Volume 1 continuing to help connect people to that is really important to us.
Thankfully, I keep getting emails from The Onion, though.
Yeah, you need as much of that as you can handle. But that's yeah, I mean, you talk, people started talking about how headlines couldn't get weirder than they had been, and now they're getting weirder.
I'm going to have Ann Katz and George Sugros later on this show at Arts Wisconsin and the Wisconsin Arts Board, so they'll have more philosophical things to say. One of my favorite phrases that I heard someone say within the past couple years was, character is who you are when no one's looking. I know that you've always been proud of the character of the Chippewa Valley, but this will really be a test. You feel good about our prospects?
I do, but it's early. It's hard to tell where this is all going. A couple of days into the turning point, where there obviously was a crisis nationally and locally, I got a call from Dale Peters, the city manager of Eau Claire, and he wanted to, you know, congratulate us for what we were doing to keep people informed and to lift up spirits, and really to cheerlead us to continue to do that. I think he was probably making a lot of those calls that day, connecting with people who he knew had some voice in the community and could help with messaging and just the tone of things out there right now. But what he said was, you know, there's studies on this kind of stuff, and he, as a city manager, he'd done some learning around these sorts of things, that we were in the phase where everybody was pulling together and helping each other out, lifting each other up, collaborating in whatever ways we could to survive. But when crises like these get longer and deeper, the tone can shift, and it can get a little bit scarier, and it can get a little bit more of individuals protecting themselves and not looking out for each other as much. Mm-hmm. That's a scary thing to think about. And so I do think the Chippewa Valley is in a good and collaborative place where we are more able to fend off that phase of a crisis like this. Maybe in some bigger cities and some places where the citizens don't feel as connected to each other as we do here in the Chippewa Valley, there's a higher risk of things going awry. But I think we're in good shape to weather that kind of storm if this gets deeper and harder.
Glad you brought up the word cheerleading, though, because in my header to my notes prepared for this interview, I had you listed as editor, publisher, owner, and cheerleader at Volume 1.
Yeah, no, I've got the pom-poms out, and we're testing our routines, yeah.
Nick, thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Nick. And Ann and George, we'll get that order back in place. Plus, you can go to WPR.org later on today, and you can hear them again. Sure. Spectrum West on Wisconsin Public Radio, where support for WPR comes from Charter Bank, dedicated to investing in partnerships and offering Charter Bank business services with small business loans, treasury management services, and a variety of checking accounts. Details are at charterbank.bank. You know, one of the going themes during all this time we have to ourselves is the predicted baby boom that may come around the end of the year. Another is all the books being consumed simply because we have the time. We'll be talking about several in coming weeks, and this week, Jim Oliver's here with one of a historical nature.
Bob Silbernagel attended the University of Wisconsin-Madison and Oshkosh and eventually retired as a journalist in 2014 after more than 35 years in the newspaper business. He spent the last 19 as editorial page editor of the Daily Sentinel in Grand Junction, Colorado. He now concentrates on writing about history, including a semi-monthly history column called First Draft. His book, The Cadots, A Fur Trading Family on Lake Superior, is being published by the Wisconsin Historical Society Press and will be released in late May. Bob Silbernagel joins us by telephone from his home in Colorado, where he is waiting out the pandemic like the rest of us. Well, Great Lakes fur trade spanned for two centuries and thousands of miles. You focus on the story of one particular family, Ojibwe French-Canadian Michel Cadot and his Ojibwe wife, whose name I can't pronounce, but they were traders and regional leaders on Madeline Island for nearly 40 years. What brought this connection with the Cadots about for you?
Obviously, we have the connection to Wisconsin. We've been traveling back there to see family almost every year, sometimes twice a year in the Madison area. But maybe 20 years ago, my wife and I decided we wanted to go visit Lake Superior, where I'd been as a child, but hadn't really been in any recent time. And while we were there, we visited Madeline Island, and the cemetery at the Catholic Church there has Michel Cadot's gravestone. I thought it was interesting, and because I'm a history fanatic, I picked up some books at the museum. There isn't any book specifically about the Karats, but I read about them in a number of different books. And I kept finding references to the Karat family during the fur trade era. And I kind of got fascinated because in my public school history education, we learned about Marquette and Joliet and stuff, but I didn't really understand how long the fur trade had been going on up in the Great Lakes area and specifically Lake Superior. And I didn't understand how important the French Canadians and the French Canadians who intermarried with the Ojibwe were. So I got interested and started doing some research, eventually turned it into a book. It went a lot of different ways I wasn't quite expecting, as books generally do, but I found the Karat family interesting as a family and the individuals in it, but also as sort of representatives of that whole ethnic background that hasn't been really deeply explored, I don't think.
What brought them to the west end of Lake Superior?
Well, Michel's father located during the French regime at Sault Ste. Marie, and worked initially with the French and then with the British. And after he began working with the British, he and some British traders began trading along primarily the south shore of Lake Superior, a little bit on the north shore to the western end. So he had some outposts, not on Madeline Island, but in the area around the Apostle Islands. And eventually his sons, Jean-Baptiste and Michel, started trading in that area. And over the years, I guess Michel and his wife, Ikwesue, found that that was a place they liked to trade and liked to live.
They got along pretty well with the Ojibwe tribe.
Yes. Well, Ikwesue was, as far as we know, a full-blood Ojibwe, descended from several important regional leaders at the west end of Lake Superior. And Michel's father, Jean-Baptiste Sr., was very involved with the Ojibwes. They had a long-standing involvement.
He is Bob Silbernagle, who is author of the book The Karats, a Fur Trading Family on Lake Superior. The Karats were noted for their leadership roles. Talk a little bit about the stuff that they did, not only the first generation, but later generations.
As I mentioned, first of all, Jean-Baptiste Karat Sr., he was very good as an interpreter, but also a leader under the French regime. And then when the French essentially ceded most of Canada to the British in 1763, he became very important and worked with the British. His son, Jean-Baptiste Jr., was also a great interpreter and was very involved in the Northwest Company and the fur trade, both in Northwest Wisconsin, Northeastern Minnesota, on into parts of Canada. He was an interpreter and a trader. Michel was not so much an interpreter. He didn't seem to have quite the linguistic skills, but he was very much an important trader at the West End, very involved with the Northwest Company, and then later with John Astor's American Fur Company. He assisted different people in exploring the region around Lake Superior and northern Wisconsin. He also assisted, as did his father and his brother, in trying to sort out and calm conflicts between different native groups. Several of Michel's sons fought in the War of 1812 on the British side, or at least acted as interpreters. I don't know how much combat they served in. His grandson, William W. Warren, wrote the first history of the Ojibwe people and also served as a legislator in the Minnesota Territorial Legislature. And several of his granddaughters were interpreters and worked with later scholars on exploring the history of the Ojibwe people. They also were school teachers. A couple of grandsons served in the Civil War from northern Wisconsin. So it was an important family during that time into the 20th century and 21st century. Some of the people I've met who are descendants of the Karats have been leaders in their community.
In the early 1700s or the early 1800s, Jean-Baptiste established a trading post on the Yellow River near modern Karat, kind of a local connection here.
My wife and I made our first visit to Karat, Wisconsin, this past summer, and it was interesting to see that community and some of the stuff. Unfortunately, the local museum wasn't open when we were there.
How long did the book take to get to the point of being released?
Well, when I first visited the cemetery on Madeline Island, that was probably almost 20 years ago. I picked up some books then, but I didn't really start researching in earnest till maybe 2009, 2010. Writing in earnest probably began about, well, really after I retired. So 2014, went through, as most books do, a number of different drafts. So I would say it was pretty much my main occupation from 2014 till the last fall when we got the final draft done. So 5 years.
You write a twice monthly history column for the paper in Colorado. Where do you get your material for that?
Well, it's called First Draft because the old guy from the Washington Post said newspapers are the first draft of history.
Okay.
And so I use a lot of newspapers. Fortunately, I live in a time when you can go to newspapers online, and Colorado historical newspapers and Utah historical newspapers have a lot of information. For instance, the most recent was about the town of Gunnison and how they enacted a quarantine during the 1918 Spanish flu epidemic, kind of timely, but there was an abundance of historical newspaper articles about that event, specifically Gunnison and its quarantine during that event.
Well, the book is The Cadots, a fur trading family on Lake Superior. We've been talking to the author, Bob Silbernagle. The book has been published by the Wisconsin Historical Society Press and is scheduled for release in late May. I'm guessing the book will be available from the publisher and from Amazon, and I suspect local booksellers will buy in because of the familiarity of the Cadot name. Bob, thanks so much for talking to us. Good luck with the book. Best wishes to you.
Thank you very much, Jim. I appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, I echo that. Thanks, Jim. You know, Spectrum West will continue to shape itself week to week around current issues, how they affect the creative sector of Western Wisconsin. We'll also bring you conversations, though, about how life goes on in spite of the issues. Like next week, we'll be talking to a mountain climbing entrepreneur, a collegiate study on our divisiveness. Maybe that'll subside in coming months. We'll also talk about the birds of spring and more. Thank you guys for being part of our audience. Thank you for doing your part in what needs doing during these trying times. Thanks, Dean, Kate, Catherine, and Jim. Live safe. Be smart. See you next week.